Hello there, you're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Wednesday the 13th of July. Today I am joined by Duncan Balcon, who is a Watson's Daily Ambassador. Hi there, Duncan, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Peter. I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good. Bit hot today, as always.
Are you regretting making all the jokes about the heat we made yesterday? Because yeah. I'm sure you, it's worse where I am today.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, no, it's not good. But, you know, hey, it's what we have. It's that part of the year, you know, week or two, where we all fantasize about having air conditioning at home. But we soldier on. Anyway, yes. Yeah, so what did you find most interesting from today's edition of Watson's Daily?
Yeah, it's always painful to talk about this, considering this is the time of year. I said yesterday everyone wants to jump on a plane and go on holiday. I want to talk about the story from the FT about Heathrow and people not being able to go on holiday, which is a little bit awkward, really, considering current
weather conditions. You party pooper.
I know, I'm horrible. Just rubbing sockets. I really apologise if there's anyone listening that has had a flight cancelled, by the way, before I start this story, because it might be salt in an open wound. This is the story from the FT. Heathrow are telling airlines to stop selling tickets for flights this summer. So they've imposed a daily limit on the number of passengers, and this is the first time they've ever done this, Heathrow. So it's monumental. It's told, like I said, airlines stop selling tickets over the next 2 months is what it's classifying as the summer, which I think is optimistic. But the big aim is to get better control over the travel situation at the moment, which is nothing really short of disastrous, particularly around airports. So they've got a limit of 100,000 passengers a day, and they're basically saying if that's breached, the incidence of longer delays and cancellations is going to go up. Mm-hmm. This just looks like a bad story all round for everybody involved to me, which is what I want to talk about today, because obviously if it's bad for a lot of people, there's a lot of kind of commercial implications of it. Obviously, first and foremost, Heathrow won't want to take this, won't have made this decision lightly, because less people through the doors means less money going into their pockets. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the airlines who haven't been able to fly properly for a couple of years. A lot of them have got big debts to pay off in terms of new fleets of planes they're paying off and things. And mm-hmm. so they need that money in from people actually flying. Mm. You've obviously got consumers are being disrupted left, right and centre. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they're able to get the money back or get an alternative flight or something, but there is a chance they won't be able to. Mm. I think also for kind of... any of the businesses that are based in the airport, so any of your retailers based in the airports, this is really bad news, because again, you've stuck with those outlets, whether it be a convenience store or a clothing store or whatever in the duty free area of the airport. You've stuck with that outlet through the pandemic, and you're trying to get your business business back up and running through it, and now footfall is going to go down, which isn't again ideal. So I think there's lots of people getting affected by this. The only people I can see that could potentially do well out of this, but again, probably too much red tape to do anything about it, is agency stuff. Agencies, I think, because I heard in the news yesterday that the reason Heathrow were quoting for why they're having to put a limit on number of passengers is they can't actually staff all the terminals at once at the moment, which is a little bit concerning. But like I said, agencies could jump on that, but then you need certain levels of qualifications and certain levels of security clearance to work at an airport. So... it kind of feels like they've hit a wall, and there's not a massively easy way round, through, or under it. That's my take on this. Like I said, I think so many people are going to be affected by this, not just the passengers. I think you're looking at all the businesses that run, operate in and out of an airport. So, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is going to be really bad, obviously, for airlines who are obviously trying to make as much money as they can after a horrendous 2 years. This is the first, like, proper summer. Or properish summer, and you know they're being held back. You could argue they're being held back by their own keenness to axe their staff. Yeah. So, but then again, you could argue, how are they to know that it was, you know, things were going to get better at this point? You know, so anyway, yes, it's a big thing for airlines. And I think it will be, not so good for retailers that are associated with airports and things. Maybe even things that are, you know, it'd be interesting to know how that will affect the likes of, you know, WH Smith or Boots or something like that, whether, because it was seen that, you know, their travel related business was starting to do well, but this is going to potentially limit the upside. But I do think it is amazing. You know, who would have thought, if you'd have said to me in, I don't know, March, April 2020, that Heathrow is going to impose a daily limit on the number of passengers, you know, I would have laughed, because you're thinking, well, no way is that going to happen, you know. But so anyway, this is very serious. It means that the money making opportunities for the airlines are going to be, you know, the upper limit is going to fall. And as you quite rightly said, I think it's the recruitment agencies who are going to rake it in, because they're not going to keep quiet on this. They're going to significantly up their rates, because they know the demand is so strong. So I think that they're the only ones who are going to do well. I do think it's a tricky situation. It is something that was sort of created by the airlines themselves, but then again, how are they to know? We have no precedent for this. So I guess this is it, really, and this is a problem, because obviously this is the time when the most people travel. But maybe lessons will be learnt from this time, and it means that, you know, staff problems will ease over the longer period, potentially.
Yeah, potentially. And like you said, it's of their own making. And we talked on this podcast during the pandemic, saying at some point, but we didn't know when this point was, people are going to rush to want to go back on holiday. But because there is no way of predicting when that's going to be, I mean, it's in human nature. The second we're allowed to do something again, we are going to go and do it at our course. But because there was no way of telling when that was going to be, there was always going to be this slight lag, wasn't there? Suddenly people have gone on holiday again, but we're actually not equipped for it. And it's just because, I think, they need to kind of get their heads around it and get back on top of it before, obviously, lose faith from consumers. But I don't think that will happen. I think obviously people are always going to want to go on holiday, aren't they? It's just, hopefully they can turn around quickly, so it's not too much disruption for too many people, particularly over the summer when people are just dying to get away.
Absolutely.
But anyway, that's what I found interesting. I said sorry for anyone that's meant to be going on holiday at any point soon. That was my favourite story. What was yours in today's Watson saying?
My favourite story of today, the one that stood out to me the most, was the story in the Times, or actually, to be honest, it's across lots of the papers today, but the world's biggest SPAC, which is the special purpose acquisition company, is very those SPAC deals have been going for quite some time now, and been very, very popular, and they've made a lot of money for companies such as Goldman Sachs and many, many others. However, the momentum seems to have the momentum for these deals has receded somewhat, because at the beginning of it all, it was a really fast way for growth companies to get to market and, you know, be traded on a stock exchange. But as time went on, we saw more failures, and it seems that the reasons why they couldn't do well traditionally and go down the traditional route came back to haunt them. And it's amazing to say, I mean, the statistic in the Financial Times says that about 90% of companies that went public via SPACs are now trading below their listing price. I mean, that's a frightening statistic. That's
shocking, isn't it? Absolutely shocking.
Yeah. Anyway, so the actual story is that this guy, Bill Ackman, who is the big cheese at Pershing Square Tontine, I think his firm's Pershing Square, I believe. But anyway, this particular fund, this SPAC, he's closing it down. So basically what he did is he collected 4 billion That's $4 billion from investors, and he was going to go out shopping for suitable assets. Anyway.
Easy. Surely that's a big purse to go shopping with.
Anyway, it turns out that that he couldn't find anything worth buying. Now, you know, you can say that this is, you know, I'm always a bit sceptical. When investment managers in particular talk about things like this. They talk about trends because they're going to talk about the trends from their point of view and they've traded on them. And then that's when they tell everyone else, is after they've done it. So it could be that it's just not right. It's just not the right asset class for him. But the thing is, he has got a, you know, big reputation in the market. And so actually, you do wonder whether this is the beginning of the end for SPACs in their current form, you know, whether maybe they will be repurposed and, you know, given another acronym. And then they'll come back again.
Another acronym for us to spend time explaining in future.
Yeah, but it is amazing, though, isn't it? I mean, literally, maybe a year and a bit ago, everyone was talking about SPACs all the time, loads and loads and loads of stuff. And, you know, and those companies that were getting listed via the SPAC route were very dismissive of the traditional fuddy-duzzy ways of doing things. But as it turns out, there's a reason for all those rules. Yeah. I mean, the main thing, it seems to me, with these is that the companies that list are, you know, all style and not that much substance. You know, lots of big promises on PowerPoints that don't actually come to fruition, because they're based on assumptions rather than reality. Yeah. So it's quite amazing. Anyway, this is a big historic moment, I think, for SPACs in general. And it's kind of ironic, really, because it's only a few months ago that the London Stock Exchange changed the rules to make it easier for SPAC listings in London. So, talk about getting to the party late.
Absolutely.
So anyway, so I do think that that's a very interesting story. It's something that will be a milestone in the history of SPACs. Maybe we'll look back at it at some point in the future and see this as the beginning of the end for them. But anyway, like I say, it's very interesting that the market always evolves, investment always evolves, and there will be something new, I guarantee, at some point in the future, because some clever people will be getting together to think about how they can do SPACs better.
Absolutely. Like you said, I think there's kind of two sides to this. Like, as you said, like, you have to take everything that an investment manager says with a slight pinch of salt, because there is always a level of bias there to some extent in terms of what they personally like investing in. But at the same time, to go out with $4 billion and come back saying, do you know what, I can't find anything, have your money back to the investors, is just shocking. And I get to some extent, obviously, Bill Ackman has... And everyone involved, sorry, it's not obviously not just him as a single person, but everyone involved has a bit of reputation to maintain, and you don't want to become part of that statistic, do you? 90% trading below the listing price. You don't want to add to that statistic if you want to keep your reputation as an investment manager.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there's obviously that side of it. But I kind of agree with you here. I think we've spoken a couple of times the last few weeks about SPACs slowing down and slowing down and losing kind of momentum, and this just feels like them hitting a brick wall. They've been fading, and this is something needs to change. Otherwise, this is, from my perspective, I think this is the end of SPACs, unless something, like I said, changes. They get a twist, they get a restructure, something. But you can't have investors investing by a model where there's at the moment, roughly speaking, 90% chance they're going to end up losing money.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure if you mentioned on the podcast, but when we were talking earlier. When we first started to talk about SPACs a couple of years ago, we quite often talked about the fact that SPACs are really good for the company that's being invested in, not so great for the investor. I think
it's very, very good for the very early investor. And like, it's very good for them, and it's good for the company because they get the, you know, get the money quickly. But for everyone else, less good. And clearly, 90% it's been less good.
And so, you can't pursue a model where 90% of the time it doesn't work. Can you? That's just not a future-proof model. So
there we go. So I think this, it's an interesting story. I thought actually there were a lot of stories in today's Watson's Daily that were mainly sort of developments from existing stories. And I'll quickly just mention this. I mean, I thought this was pretty amazing, and I thought it was worth mentioning. Is that talk about lawyers' salaries, newly qualified salaries. Wow, that's a lot of money. I mean, Baker McKenzie, 110 grand. Herbert Smith Freehills, 120. Freshfields Bruckhouse Derringer, I don't know how you say it, 125. Allen and Overy sticking at 107,500. And then Aiken Gump, I mean, £179,000 for a newly qualified lawyer. That is astounding. I think, and I come from an investment banking background. That is astounding.
It is, isn't it?
I would say if you are a lawyer listening to this, it is quite incredible what's going on here. But I would say to those thinking about it, thinking, oh, I definitely want to do, I'd definitely like to do that, do it for the money, just to say that these kinds of salaries do not come without a downside in terms of work life balance. I mean, you're not gonna, I am thinking here that you're not gonna be not these jobs aren't gonna be 9 till 5 and everyone leaves early on a Friday for that sort of thing, because they will definitely want value for money. But it is quite incredible, and I put them in there today because I just noticed recently, I've not really bothered putting them in, but there's so many of these things going on that I just thought I had to, really. But anyway, yes, a lot of money going on. Anyway, right. So we'll bring this to a close. I think that, just wanted to obviously add again that we are looking for ambassadors, please look on our socials. I'll be releasing a few videos and stuff as well soon, just to tell you a bit more as well. But, have a look on our socials. The application form is on there. If you'd like to help us, it'll be absolutely brilliant. I'll leave it there. But thank you very much indeed for your time. As always, a pleasure. And thanks for the listeners for listening, and we will see you again tomorrow. Many thanks. Bye.